You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org. There's an app for that. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Now, I've read a fair number of the books on intelligent design, and they seem to me to be a very conservative approach. They don't make wild claims. They tend to be very specific in the arguments that they're making, very narrow in the arguments that they're making. And it's not something, just reading this as someone who is committed to a biblical model of creation. Okay, I'll lay my cards on the table right there. Reading it as someone who's committed to that viewpoint, as a part of the part and parcel of the Christian faith, I find the claims of intelligent designers to be modest, and I say that with intending it as a compliment to be modest. But why the response from the defenders of Darwinian orthodoxy is so seemingly out of proportion? They just stop doing science altogether, and they start calling names. What is going on? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Casey Luskin joins us to talk about responding to the rhetorical tactics of committed evolutionists. He's a research coordinator for the Discovery Institute, co-founder of IDEA, Intelligent Design and Evolution Awareness Center, and he's author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Letting Science, Not Rhetoric, Drive the Debate Over Intelligent Design. Casey, welcome to Issues Etc.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I wonder about this. They are such modest claims made by the proponents of intelligent design. Why have the defenders of Darwinian orthodoxy abandoned reasoned discourse and debate?
Well, I think the answer is actually not too complicated. I think it's because when the facts are not on your side, it's a lot easier to yell and scream. And so when the evidence is not supporting their view, they figure the easiest way to win the argument is to turn up the volume and start basically engaging in name-calling and personal attacks. And that's what we see them doing all the time these days.
Is that what the ID, the articles, the books, is that what they're doing in essence is highlighting the fact that, contrary to their constant refrain, the Darwinian evolutionists do not have all the facts on their side?
That's a big part of what intelligent design arguments say. We make the point that Darwinian evolution is not wrong about everything. There are obviously some aspects of Darwinism which are totally uncontroversial. The idea that life changes over time, perhaps even the idea that some organisms share a common ancestor, those notions are not necessarily entirely controversial. But when you get into claims that an unguided process of natural selection acting upon random mutation, that was the driving force to produce the complexity of life, well, here you run into a lot of problems with the evidence. And so what ID proponents are saying is that there's a limit to what natural selection can do, and that a better explanation for many aspects of biological complexity is an intelligent cause or a personal agent.
Okay, here's an example, and I want you to give us some examples of the kind of rhetorical response that it received. You talk about Michael Behe's book, The Edge of Evolution, where he makes exactly that argument. There are definite and provable limits to what Darwinian evolution can say and prove. What's the response been like? Give us some examples.
Yeah, well, Michael Behe is a biochemist at Lehigh University, and he wrote a book. His first book was called Darwin's Black Box. It came out in 1996, and he made the argument that many biochemical systems are too complex to have evolved by an unguided natural selection process. The sequel to his book, Darwin's Black Box, came out in 2007, and that's the book you just mentioned, The Edge of Evolution. And in The Edge of Evolution, what Behe does is he says, well, look, there are some things which Darwinian evolution can do. It can produce antibiotic resistance. It can allow bacteria to become resistant to drugs. It can allow larger organisms like you or me to become resistant to certain diseases like malaria. Darwinian evolution is very good at breaking structures in the cell. So what he says is that there are certain things which Darwinian evolution can do. But then he says there's a limit. There's a limit to what Darwinian evolution can do, or an edge, as he puts it, an edge to evolution. And he asks the question, exactly where is this edge to evolution? And what Behe hones in on is the idea that some structures in our bodies and in biological systems will require multiple mutations to exist before they provide any advantage to the organism. And until all of those mutations are in place, that structure, that system, will not provide any advantage to the organism. These multi-mutation features, Behe finds, are beyond the edge of evolution. Now, it's a pretty basic argument. As a matter of fact, some leading evolutionary biologists, like Jerry Coyne at the University of Chicago, have conceded that if we can find structures where every minuscule mutation does not provide an advantage, that will challenge natural selection. So in theory at least, Behe is not way off. Now, the responses to Behe have been totally disproportional to the very modest argument that he's making. And we can get into that a little bit, but, folks, basically heads were exploding after Behe made this argument in the evolutionary community. Ken Miller, a well-known evolutionary scientist at Brown University, accused Behe of, quote, a breathtaking abuse of statistical genetics, unquote. Richard Dawkins, who we all know of and have heard of before, he said he feels sorry for Behe and that Behe seems to have given up. And it goes on to say that Behe is a disowned biochemist who should reestablish his scientific credentials and start over. And all of this is simply because Behe said that natural selection and random mutation cannot do everything that it's claimed to do. And again, this caused heads to explode in the evolutionary community.
Now, key to this and to Behe's argument is a concept called stepwise evolutionary pathway. Can you explain what that means?
Sure, absolutely. Darwinian evolution requires that biological structures evolve one small step at a time. Basically, each small mutation or each small variation has to provide an advantage to the organism, or natural selection will have no reason to preserve it. So you have to evolve things one little step at a time. As a matter of fact, Darwin said in Origin of Species that if it could be demonstrated that an organ existed which could not be formed by numerous successive slight modifications, then my theory would absolutely break down. So Darwin himself said that his theory only worked when you could evolve structures through numerous successive slight modifications. And that makes sense because in nature, we don't tend to see, large jumps of complexity happening by chance. You'll get one little mutation at a time. So the question that has to be asked now is, can you get structures that we see in biology, can they evolve in a step-by-step fashion? And Michael Behe says the answer is no, that many of these structures and these systems require lots of parts to be present all at once, or many mutations to be present all at once before there is any advantage to the organism. And as a result, they cannot evolve in the step-by-step manner that Darwin required.
What I have heard, and this is kind of more in the popular, not in the scientific literature, I think Darwinian evolutionists are aware of the problem because they'll say things like, well, before this organ was fully formed in this creature, it must have provided some unknown benefit to the organism that we don't know about, but they simply assume it must have because they are aware that it has to, aren't they?
You're absolutely right. Whether it's made explicit or it's just implicit, evolutionary theorists are aware of the fact that each step of an evolutionary scheme has to provide some advantage to the organism. One of the more, sort of imaginative or speculative examples we've seen in the last few years is when evolutionists try to explain the origin of feathers. Now, feathers, of course, are very carefully, finely tuned structures that are precisely finely tuned to allow for flight in birds, and there are many features of feathers which really are quite amazing in their precision of allowing flight. But when you look at a feather, what could a feather do for you if it was not allowing you to fly? Well, some evolutionary scientists have said, feathers originally did not evolve to allow for flight. they evolved to allow some kind of insulation or some kind of heat regulation structure to help organisms maintain their body temperature. They had nothing to do with flight. So here we have this amazing structure that today is extremely intricately designed for flight, and yet originally evolutionary scientists say it did not arise for anything that, for a purpose that had anything to do with flight. I find that, you know, not to be a compelling argument, forgive me, but, you know, this is what evolutionary scientists have to do. They have to come up with some advantage that the structure gave to the organism, even if it had nothing to do with the final function of that structure.
Now, you highlight this, and you're going to have to explain some of the science to us a little bit, but in The Edge of Evolution by Michael Behe, he focuses in on, what is it? Is it a malaria bacterium, is that what it is? And he kind of makes his argument on that ground. What does he say?
Yeah, Behe is looking at basically the resistance that occurs to malaria in living organisms, things like you and me, how we become resistant to malaria. Malaria is, of course, a microorganism that causes disease in humans and lots of other organisms. It's actually not a bacterium or a virus. It's a eukaryotic protist. And they tend to infect, people, and then they'll cause all kinds of problems. Well, some people are resistant to malaria. And Behe finds that, that's not what I meant to say. What I meant to say is some malaria is resistant to the antibiotic drugs that we throw at it when trying to kill malaria. And Behe tries to ask the question, how likely is it for malaria to evolve resistance to our antibiotic drugs? And so Behe found that resistant malarial cells are very rare. They occur about 1 in 10 to the 20th cells. And although that sounds very rare for a malaria cell to become resistant to our antibiotic drugs, there are actually so many cells each year that at least about one example of a resistant malaria cell will pop up each year. And so this is basically where Behe is saying this is something that is within the edge of evolution, but this leads him to other questions. We can get into that later.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Casey Luskin of the Discovery Institute about responding to the rhetorical tactics of Darwinian evolutionists.
Hi, this is Jonathan calling from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Owen's story can inspire us all.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Diagnosed with a congenital defect before he was born, little Owen James' doctors gave different predictions of what his life might be like. His parents were grateful that the most severe problems didn't become clear until he was 33 weeks along, so abortion wasn't even discussed. Now he's 5, and Owen's mother says, "While the doctors may do tests to try and predict how a baby will do, there's just no way to know until they are born and show how much they're able to fight. Many that you wouldn't think could make it do."
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilk. We're talking with Casey Luskin of the Discovery Institute about responding to the rhetorical tactics of evolutionists. Before the break, you were talking about Michael Behe's book, The Edge of Evolution, and how he's arguing there that it is statistically remote, the possibility there, that these resistances in the organism that causes malaria to antibiotic drugs could be developed by stepwise evolutionary pathways. But you say that the critics completely missed Behe's point. What happened?
Yeah, Behe actually acknowledged that it is possible for resistance of malaria to our antibiotic drugs to evolve in a stepwise fashion. Behe basically said that malaria resistance to antibiotic drugs is very rare. It happens about 1 in every 10 to the 20th cells. So that's a very rare occurrence. But because there are so many malarial cells that exist each year, we actually observe that this malaria resistant strain of malaria crops up about one time per year. So clearly this structure or this type of resistance can evolve, whether it's evolving by a stepwise evolutionary pathway or whatever. It's an empirical data point that we observe from sort of public health data that malaria resistance pops up. And Behe's point is, okay, if it takes 10 to the 20th cells to produce a very simple system like this malaria resistance to our antibiotic drugs, then what would be necessary to produce more complex systems which require many fundamentally new genes and proteins? And since higher organisms like you or me don't have the short generation times and huge population sizes of rapidly evolving microorganisms like malaria, then Behe argues that the evolution of complex systems in higher organisms like you or me is very unlikely. And there are a number of research papers that back Behe that we can get into, but basically his point is, if it takes 10 to the 20th cells just to produce, you know, resistance to an antibiotic drug in malaria, which is really not that complex, what's it going to take to produce, you know, far more complex systems?
Okay, let's talk about some of the actual tactic that's employed here. You break it down into several steps that it's a rhetorical device. It is not an argument against anything that Behe actually states, but it's, I would call it an ad hominem, to put it simply. But what are the steps in this rhetorical response that Behe and others in the ID community often meet with?
Yeah, I mean, that's right, Todd. It really is an ad hominem. And, you know, for your listeners who are going to go out there and maybe debate this issue of evolution or intelligent design, they need to be aware that one of the primary debate tactics of evolutionists today is to use ad hominem attacks against proponents of intelligent design. And so, you know, you need to be basically ready to sort of count the cost and realize that if you go out and defend an ID viewpoint, you're going to get attacked. You're going to be called names. You're going to be called ignorant, stupid, dumb, uninformed. You're going to be called all these things. So sort of be prepared ahead of time that when you go into the debate, you know, you're aware of the fact this is going to happen, and you're not going to respond back in a nasty way. You're going to respond back in a nice, kind, loving, and civil way, even when they treat you, you know, like dirt, basically. But this is what happened to Behe. His critics, first they sort of would assert that intelligent design has failed, and Behe's book, they sort of mocked it as a futile comeback attempt. And then they would critique his book, The Edge of Evolution, but they would not do it just for scientific analysis. And this is very common. We don't see evolutionists just making scientific arguments. They try to go all out, basically, and say that not only are you wrong, but you are wrong, and you're immoral, and you're stupid, and really you have no business in civilized society even holding this position. And the conclusion, of course, is that Michael Behe has lost any credibility, and then they even sometimes would suggest that he's dishonest. And, you know, as an ID proponent, I've been called all kinds of names. This happens to many of us all the time, and I'm not here to complain about it. Frankly, when people start calling me names, that's usually a sign that I've won the argument, because you got to figure if they had something better to say, they wouldn't be resorting to name calling. But, you know, this is something that's very common, and we need to be prepared to deal with it and understand how to respond to it.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that Darwin himself admitted to the falsifiability of his theory. He said if this could be proven to be false, my theory would fall apart. His ideological descendants, the Darwinists of today, are they willing to admit the falsifiability of the theory?
Generally, the answer to that question is no. I frankly think that Darwin is rolling over in his grave over the way that many modern-day defenders of Darwinism are defending his own theory. Not only are they treating, you know, critics of Darwinism in some pretty terrible ways, but they refuse to treat their theory as if it's falsifiable. So when you get structures which cannot evolve in a step-by-step-by-step fashion, instead of admitting that perhaps we've actually found some structures that falsify natural selection and Darwinian explanations, what modern-day evolutionists will do is they will resort to these highly speculative just-so stories. We'll say, you know, they'll say, well, maybe originally this structure, you know, like talking about the feather, maybe originally feathers evolved to keep an organism warm, or, you know, to provide some kind of a way for it to regulate its and maintain its body temperature. Okay, fine. I mean, this is all nice to speculate about, but at the end of the day, this is nothing more than untestable speculation. And there's a lot of what I would call just-so stories that we see coming out of the evolutionary community today when they don't have any hard evidence for how these structures evolved, and they refuse to allow Darwinian evolution to be falsified, and they try to save it through sort of unwarranted speculation.
The irony here is just palpable, because isn't that precisely what they accuse? Well, generally they accuse creationists of the just-so story, but they also paint with the same brush against ID proponents.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's tons of what you might call hypocrisy going on, where, you know, they will accuse us of making untestable claims and sort of just speculating, when in fact, when you look at the evolutionary literature and you look at it, what it says about how basically complex biochemical systems arise, you don't see explanations. Instead, you see speculation. The most evidence you'll see in terms of hard evidence goes is you'll see comparisons of gene sequences between one structure and another. You'll say, okay, well, this structure is, say, the bacterial flagellum, which is an outboard motor on bacteria. People will say, well, this structure has genes with a certain amino acid sequence, and we find another gene somewhere else in biology that has a similar amino acid sequence. So therefore, these two must be related. Therefore, they must have evolved from a common ancestor. Okay, well, the fact that they share a similar gene sequence could be explained by common ancestry, but that's not an evolutionary explanation. That's not a Darwinian explanation for how a complex micromolecular machine can evolve in a step-by-step fashion. Finding that it's similar to something else, that doesn't tell you how it evolved. So, yeah, we see this kind of, I would call it, you know, just speculation all the time in the evolutionary literature.
But what they say of the flagellum, don't they actually say that about whole organisms, too? Don't they say, in essence, what we have today that we can examine by way of end product, so to speak, of this blind chance time and random mutation is kind of similar to what we can find back here in the fossil record. Therefore, there must be some evolutionary connection between the two.
Sure. I mean, it is something like that. They'll look for sort of loose and tenuous connections between different structures, and then sort of just fill in all the gaps using inferences, even if the hard evidence isn't there. And yeah, we see that in the fossil record too, where the fossil record will be full of significant gaps and very large unbridged gaps, and then they will say, well, you know, we'll just infer that there had to be evolutionary intermediates that lived here, and they're just not preserved because the fossil record is incomplete. That's another great example of how evolutionary scientists refuse to allow their theory to be refuted, where, you know, instead of saying, okay, you know what, yeah, the fossil evidence is not consistent with Darwinian theory, they will say, well, really, the fossil record is just incomplete, and it always happens to be incomplete in the places where we're looking for transitional forms. And you commonly see this kind of reasoning taking place.
So, in fact, has Behe, even from evolutionary science's own pens, has Behe at least begun to be vindicated, if not respected?
Well, I think so. I think that there are a number of research papers that are backing Behe's claims. As a matter of fact, Behe co-published a paper in the journal Protein Science a couple years ago where he tried to look at the evolution of these multi-mutation features that we were talking about earlier. And Behe found that basically if there's structures that require more than two amino acids to be fixed and present all at once in order for them to function, those types of systems, those types of structures are very unlikely to evolve in higher multicellular organisms like you and me. Now, the irony of this is that a couple years later, two critics of Michael Behe tried to refute him in the journal Genetics, and they found that to obtain only two simultaneous mutations, via Darwinian evolution within humans would take greater than 100 million years. And they admitted this was, quote, very unlikely to occur on a reasonable timescale, unquote. So, you know, basically they're finding that to simply get two simultaneous mutations is more than could happen. You know, over it would take over 100 million years for this to happen in a population of an organism like humans. So clearly many structures are going to be beyond the edge of evolution if we were to take what even Behe's critics are now finding seriously.
We'll take a break when we come back. It sounds like what the Darwinian evolutionists lack is enough time. I mean, and it seems to be the appeal here, that if we had just enough time, and when the time scales exceed that even of their alleged existence of an organism, well, they got a problem. They got a real problem, and they don't have unlimited time either. Casey Luskin is our guest. He's a research coordinator for the Discovery Institute. We're talking about responding to the rhetorical tactics of evolutionists. We will post a link to the Discovery Institute under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. We are coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon, the 21st of February. Our call-in number for your questions and your comments live this Tuesday, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address is talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org, and our Twitter address @issuesetc.
Think big screens belong in the movie theater, not at church? Think garage bands should stay in the garage, not be jamming in front of the altar? Hey, we do too. Come join us at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, for services that are reverent and relevant, vibrant and traditional. Divine service on Saturday at 6 p.m., on Sunday morning at 7:45 and 10, with Sunday school and Bible class in between at 9. Join us. Not a big screen or garage band in sight. Promise.
Did you know that you can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by donating stocks, bonds, and mutual funds to Lutheran Public Radio? For more information, contact Craig at 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. Please consider donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds to Issues Etc. this year. Call Craig today, 618-223-8385. Thanks for your support.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Our listeners are responding very favorably to something that we offered them for free. Listeners always like things for free. This is a real benefit to them because it helps them do what they do so well, and that is listen to Issues Etc. in its many forms, either live or on demand, and access just about everything Issues Etc. has to offer. They're the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android apps, and they are absolutely free at our website, issuesetc.org. With these, you have Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. You can listen live and on demand and access all those other things that we offer our listeners absolutely free. You can find them both at our website, issuesetc.org. There's a link right there on the homepage. There's also a place up in the Listen menu where you can download either the Issues Etc. iPhone app or the Issues Etc. Android app. We're talking with Casey Luskin for the next 10 minutes, responding to the rhetorical tactics of evolutionists. It sounds like what even the evolutionists are admitting when trying to refute Behe is that there simply isn't enough time in their model for their model to work. Am I oversimplifying it?
You're exactly right, Todd. That's the problem, is that there's not enough time to generate the complex features that we're observing in biology. About 2 years ago, a pro-ID molecular biologist named Douglas Axe did a study which was published in the journal Biocomplexity, where he was trying to ask, what is the maximum number of mutations that could arise in a multi-mutation feature over the entire history of the Earth? And he granted some very generous assumptions to Darwinian evolution in this study. He basically assumed a very large population of rapidly evolving bacteria over the entire course of the history of the Earth, and he asked, okay, well, what is the maximum number of mutations that could arise if a feature required all those mutations before giving any advantage to the organism? And he basically found that the maximum number of mutations that could arise would be about 6. If a feature required more than 6 mutations before giving an advantage to the organism, it cannot arise over the entire history of the Earth. So, I mean, this is really a problem, because it's likely, actually, that very simple evolutionary changes, like converting one protein into a very similar protein, might require more than 6 mutations before you would get any advantage to the organism. So even very simple changes, supposed evolutionary changes that have taken place, would require more change than could be produced in the entire history of the Earth if we sort of grant, you know, these very generous assumptions to Darwinian evolution. So the problem, just to boil it all down, is that there is too much complexity in many biological systems for that complexity to arise over the short time scale allowed in the history of the Earth.
So are there any on the Darwinian side who, although they may not like Michael Behe or his ideas, are there any who are, at least within their circles, saying, wait, guys, we don't have all the facts on our side. Let's stop acting like we do.
There are a few voices that are urging caution. Not a lot, just a few. And if you sort of expand it from just the Darwinian side to maybe the, you know, the materialist side, you might say, people who believe that ultimately materialist explanations are going to carry the day, then yeah, there are a few people who have been critical of the traditional Darwinian paradigm. Austin Hughes, a evolutionary biology professor at the University of South Carolina, has noted that it actually is difficult to explain how sometimes features can get fixed into populations if they don't provide a very strong advantage to the organism. Another biologist named James Shapiro has recognized that Darwinian explanations for the origin of complex biological features are often weak. There are a few others as well, but the bottom line is that these people still are within, you know, the materialistic consensus, and that they are still holding that ultimately materialistic explanations are going to carry the day. But yeah, there are a few people who are willing to admit that there are problems, you know, at least publicly admit, I should say, that there are problems with this paradigm. You know, you go out and have a beer with some of these guys, and you might get them to admit more to you than they'll admit in when they go publicly talk about this issue. But the bottom line is that if you look at the technical literature, we are finding more and more criticisms of natural selection, of the view of Darwin's grand tree of life. A lot of these sort of central tenets of Darwinian theory are coming under increasing attack in the technical scientific literature.
Ken, a listener, says, I wonder if your guest is familiar with the National Geographic cover story a few years back, which claimed to have found a fossil, which was supposedly a link between land and flighted animals. They later had to retract that discovery as a fake, but they still defended the concept to a degree, the faked fossil. Do you know the story?
Yeah, I do know that story. The fossil was supposedly called Archaeoraptor, and I believe this was in, this was a number of years back. This might have been like 1999 or somewhere around there. And yeah, this fossil was portrayed on the cover of National Geographic. They claimed that it was, you know, another one of these examples of feathered dinosaurs, which supposedly shows that birds evolved from dinosaurs basically about 150 million years ago. It turned out later, however, that this fossil was a fake. And basically, National Geographic had push this this story, this evolutionary story, on the public without carefully vetting the research to see if it was correct and solid. They did retract the story, but it was a buried retraction. They buried a little letter to the editor a couple months later, after the fraud was exposed, from the scientist that had done the research, saying, "Look, he didn't know that at the time it was a fake fossil." And later on, they did do studies that determined it was fake, and now he's retracting his claims. And basically, they buried it in a little letter to the editor. So, that's not exactly a good way to retract an entire cover story with a tiny little letter to the editor that's, just buried in the issue a few months later. But this is what's going on. There is an agenda among many folks in the big science media to push evolution on the public, and we see this a lot. The feathered dinosaur story is just one of many examples where we see, fossils that are touted as alleged, quote-unquote missing links, as they often put it, and then later it turns out that those fossils were not all that they were cracked up to be. There was an example a couple years ago where this story came out about this fossil named Ida that was supposedly an early ancestor of primates, that ultimately a human ancestor if you go back far enough. And they said that this is the link that connects us with the rest of the animal kingdom. The History Channel, BBC, they all did documentaries featuring this story, featuring this fossil, and pushing it as proof of human, primate ancestry. Well, what happened later on, the technical papers studied the fossil in great detail, and eventually they determined that this probably had nothing to do with human origins, and it was a little lemur-like thing that lived about 50 million years ago. It was a beautiful fossil, but it didn't really have any significant evolutionary implications at all. And we could go on and on and on with examples like this, where evolutionists were pushing particular fossils as allegedly, proving and demonstrating Darwinian evolution, and then it turned out later that the fossils were not what they had claimed it was. And again, the retractions are usually buried, not nearly as prominent as when they were pushing the fossil originally. And this is part of this campaign to push evolution on the public.
You mentioned earlier that we can kind of now see quite clearly the game plan of those who want to discredit intelligent design and its proponents. And they've resorted to an abandoned reasoned discourse. They've resorted to these rhetorical tactics. Do you think there's really a chance of a real discourse, a real debate here between ID and Darwinian evolution at this point? Is there a chance of getting it back on reasoned grounds?
There is a chance. It's going to take, though, folks on both sides of this debate to start standing up for academic freedom and to start saying that, look, we need to stop politicizing this debate. We need to stop pretending that the ID folks aren't raising interesting questions, which, as you talked about at the beginning, they will often try to address ID questions and ID challenges, but then they won't actually say that these challenges are coming from ID. So, we need to start having an honest, open conversation about this. What it's going to take is some folks on both sides of this issue to make a universal call for academic freedom for scientists to be able to have an honest, open discussion about this. There are a few folks in the materialist camp that are sort of calling for an honest, open discussion on this, but not very many, certainly not enough to make it happen. So I think that really the way that this debate is going to progress forward is that the ID camp needs to continue to do what it's been doing, and that's publishing peer-reviewed scientific research papers that show that our ideas and our challenges to Darwinism hold merit. And over time, it's going to be harder and harder for the Darwinian scientific community to just ignore and dismiss what we're saying. They're going to have to address it. And I think at that point, but once that happens, all the walls are going to fall down. I mean, literally, the barbarians at that point will come through the gate, and the Darwinian evolutionary community will no longer be able to put out this facade that their theory has no weaknesses and that there's, really no hard questions that need to be asked about their view. So they don't want to do that, but eventually it's going to have to happen.
Casey Luskin is a research coordinator for the Discovery Institute, co-founder of IDEA, Intelligent Design and Evolution Awareness Center, author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Letting Science, Not Rhetoric, Drive the Debate Over Intelligent Design. Thank you very much, Casey.
Well, thank you.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is a great resource for pastors and for their congregations. It's called Pastors and Elders. It's not a how-to manual as much as it is a what-is manual, talking about the divine institution of the pastoral office and the church's support of that office, the preaching of the gospel, and the administration of the sacraments. It comes from a guest here on the program, Pastor Timothy Meck, and from Concordia Publishing House. Give them a call and order Pastor and Elders, Caring for the Church and One Another, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.